The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
One last detail, then we'll get back on the bus. Although I'm open to questions. By the way, well, two details. You see these purple thorn flowers? Okay? Kitzonei HaShoshan? Those are protective flowers. You're not allowed to pick them. I don't think anybody would do anything to you if you pick them. But if a police officer walked by who knew his stuff, and saw you pick one of these, you could get a fine. But what it really means to Israelis, when they put it on the protective flowers, is that we don't pick them. Now, if you did pick them, you'd find out why it's really not worth picking them. That's another discussion. You will also see Kalaniyot. Kalaniyot are beautiful flowers sometimes. They dot the side of the mountains. They're very rare this time of year. They grow out of the cleft of the rock. And when we had a D, so my wife wanted, Yonatan was born like a month early, and he at the beginning, when he was first born, had a very tough fight, and Baruch Hashem, it's fine. And so when Adi was born, our third, she wanted to give her a name that would be like, she'll be tough with one of these issues. So she was thinking, I want someone tough. I kid her about it sometimes. What did you daven for? So her second name is Kalanit. Because these flowers, anywhere, they grow out of the cleft of the rock, sides of mountains, they're tough. And it's interesting that years later, this proved to be something that was a wise thing. The other thing that's worth mentioning is, you ever have Golan wine?
Yeah.
Unbelievable wine, right? Yeah. Right there. Those are the vineyards of the Golan wineries.
Huh.
In fact, what's interesting is that when, and we don't have the time for this, but if you go to Katrin, that's where they have the plant, they have a winery there, they bottle it, they give you a tour, they have free wine tasting. So, you know, when you organize the mission that comes to Israel for 4 weeks, we do 2 weeks of learning and 2 weeks of touring, then we'll stay up in the Golan for a couple of days, and I'll take you to Katrin, and we'll do a wine tasting tour that'll blow your mind.
Yeah.
And everybody will enjoy the rest of the day.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
What's interesting is that in the late 90s, when they were talking about giving up the Golan, and there's this whole campaign here, so the Golan winery, you know, I mean, if they give up the Golan, you know, and your Golan wines, right? So they decided they had to start looking looking into where else they could produce this type of wine. There's no place else in Israel that they can replicate the climate and geological conditions that allow them to grow the wines that they grow here. There are only two places in the world that they found that could support their type of wines, of vines. One of them is in, anyone guess?
California,
Napa Valley, California. And the other is outside of Palace in Bordeaux wine country. This is the third greatest site for growing wine in the world. Yarden has wines up here. Golan Winery has wines up here. The actual border, if you look at the vineyards here, you look at the green. You see where the green ends? That's the border.
So is this UN here, Benny?
This is the UN base. It's a lot of guys. Well, they got a swimming pool. They got a TV.
Do they cover the whole border?
This they cover this area of the Golan border. It's not their only base. I have a hard enough time keeping track of the facts on the Israeli military. I'm not going to become an expert on the UN. You know what the official what UN stands for? Uninvited nobodies. That's what they call them here.
Is it true it's only 15 miles to Damascus?
It is 60 kilometers to Damascus. 60 kilometers is about 25-30 miles. You could drive it in half an hour with no problem. Realize what it must have been like to have to take this. In 67, they took Bentel from that side and they took Avital from this side. They used the volcanic structure as a defensive position. And the reason they took this side was because this was the area that wasn't mined.
How do you even take something like this?
Psychotically. כן, היית בקונטה? מה אתה אומר? מה, ב-74, 73?
71,
72. היית בקדוש
12?
So our bus driver Moshe, in the early 70s, before we gave it back after the Yom Kippur War, actually spent time serving in Konetra. So he can tell you where the best falafel in Konetra is. Okay, you look on your right, and you will see very clearly some of the carnage. This is actually a 73 tank. That was an Israeli turret. It was found loaded here. and obviously blown off a tank, and it was put there as a symbol. Look directly ahead of you, okay? And you will see the Hermon, okay? That's the Hermon mountain range, part of Syria, off in the distance. More importantly, that is, by the way, snow-capped in the winter. You can see the Hermon position way up on top in the haze, okay? When we turn, you'll see it more clearly. It'll be on your right. You can also look directly ahead of us, and you will see a sort of yellow hill with a very clear brown blotch on the side of the hill. Looks like they dug out the dirt. It's directly ahead of me, and now it's going to be coming up sort of on your right. All right? When you look a little further to your right, you'll see a low hill with like two little tops. And to the right of it, you'll see a white path, okay? The story I'm going to tell you in a few moments takes place between that ridge of the brown blotch and what's called the booster, the ridge on the right here. This valley that is on our right, you can see, is geographically and geologically a natural valley that opens all the way into Syria. Okay? Now, something important worth considering. There are only a couple of ways when you consider the mountains of the Golan above the Kinneret that we saw on the map. When you consider the valleys, okay? By the way, you are unfortunately at the end of the season. If you would have come here about a month ago, 5 weeks ago, you would have seen this place full of cherry orchards. We have them down in Gush Etzion. Could have picked cherries. Look at this road. You notice how narrow this road is? This is a great example of a Syrian road. The Syrians saved money at the expense of comfort. The Westerners build bigger, spend money because they want it to be more comfortable. You can always recognize a road that's an old Syrian road. This is built by the Syrians, the road we're driving on. Okay?
Is it two-way or one-way?
Well, it depends what rank you are. Okay, if we took a drive off to the left, you'd enter a closed military zone, so we won't go there. By the way, I mentioned earlier that this is a volcanic area. Okay, all this area was live volcano millions of years ago. And in fact, a volcano exploded here millions of years ago and created a natural volcanic lake, which is what we're driving through. Okay? This was a lake that was created by lava. And you will see very clearly when you drive up the side of the mountain and you look off to your right, because we're going to turn around the bus in a minute, you'll see that this is a natural volcanic lake. And because it's a volcanic lake and the lava mixed with... Imagine that you pour something burning on top of some muck. It melts the muck, right? So the lava melts the earth and allows many of the minerals to mix with the earth and come up to the surface. So the land in the valley is very rich in all sorts of minerals. And therefore you can grow things that you can't grow anywhere else in the world. And one of them are a particular type of wine, which is very expensive wines, which is why there is a vineyard here in this valley. Okay? It's very special earth, and it's a very protected area from the wind. And so you can grow certain types of grapes here. The grapes that are produced here are for a type of wine from the Arden Winery. I forget the name of the bottle because I'm not like a bucky in these things. I think it's a Chablis, and it's $120 a bottle.
Wow.
Okay? All right, now we're going to drive up a road. We're heading up to the top of that ridge that we were just at the bottom of. And once again, this is the only road to get up to the top of this ridge. Okay, to Har Ben Tal. And in 1967, it goes without saying that you cannot take these positions, right? You can't take the Golan without taking each of these positions, right? So once again, as we drive up into the position you'll see in a minute, tanks are coming around the bend, and since the enemy knows that that's the only way to come, they're under tremendous, tremendous pressure, right? Israel has a doctrine which is very different from the Russian doctrine, because the Russians always put their officers in the rear, so the officers could direct the battle. Israel believes, in fact, if you remember, the Franks told us about the story of Latrun. The Battle of Latrun was that place where the legend of Acharai was born, because they did seven waves of attack to try to take the fortress of Latrun along the Tel Aviv-Jerusalem highway. They took immigrants straight off the boat. Hundreds of Jews were killed, and the officers led their men into battle screaming, "Follow me." And that became a tradition in the Israeli army, that the officers lead the way. Now in Lebanon and in places like the Golan, where a lot of the warfare is mountain warfare, and you're in a narrow column of tank, that means that the person responsible for getting around the bend, right, is the officer. And so we lost a disproportionate number of officers in the Yom Kippur War. By the way, the thing we're going over now is a cow stopper, right? There are dairy farms in the area. Cows will cross over that, and they'll wander into minefields. And so those things get the cows who've stuck, and then they can come and rescue them and save them. Now look how you have this whole flat area, okay? This is actually called the Meroma Golan. It's another one of the settlements in the area. And you can see how there are low hills. They're called Telim. Okay, Tel is a low hill. And these Telim, Tel Yosifun, Tel Bental, right? All of these different Telim control the Golan Heights. And there's a line of Jewish, of Israeli-held Telim, hills on this side. There's a line of Syrian Telim on the opposite side, and we sort of control these positions opposite us, and that balance of power has kept peace on the Golan since 1973. By the way, if you look out your window on the right as we pass it by, you will be able to see very clearly the marks that the lava made pouring down the sides of the mountain millions of years ago. This is lava. This is volcanic lava on your right. Now think about this. It's 1967, you're a tank column, you're coming around this corner, and you don't know what's waiting for you. And you're going to walk right into it. So what they did was, they sent first an infantry unit up the ridge that's to our left. They came all the way up this ridge. Of course, the Syrians knew that that would happen. They built a bunker at the top of the ridge. Imagine, on foot, trying to take this position by coming up under the fire of that bunker position on your left. Do you see that? 1967. Look to your left, and you will see in a moment, and if you don't, it'll become very, a very weird thing. It looks like a little dinosaur. You see that? It's a little toys like sculpture, little children's sculpture. You see that? Okay, so just past the dinosaur, I think, a little further on, up by the bunker there, there's a red roof. Okay? That red roof of the bathrooms. So we're going to meet by the dinosaur, just so we can enter the position together. I'm going to stop by the bunker.
Can I get a picture with your gun?
1 second. Hang on. We will be here the better part of an hour. So I'm thinking that's what we'll do. We'll eat lunch now. Okay, I'll tell you the first part of the story for 2 minutes here. We'll go and we'll have lunch, and then I'll tell you the rest of the story after lunch. Make sense?
Yes.
We do need the guitar. Where is that, under the bus? Mi guitarra su guitarra. What we're going to do is I'm going to show you basically one thing over there. Then we're going to walk in. There's a cafe called Kofi Annan. Okay? Coffee, like drink coffee.
Yeah.
They have great coffee.
Good.
Okay? Annan means in the clouds. Coffee in the clouds. When you see the view, you'll see why it's called Coffee in the Clouds. They called it Kofi Annan because the head of the UN was called Kofi Annan, and he came to visit here. And they opened up this cafe in 1999, I think it was. Same reason. Do you notice how so many things opened here in 99? We were just almost there, we could taste it, right? So it's still called Kofi Annan, right? Kof also means a monkey, but I'm not going to go there.
Yeah.
Anyway. So when you see that cafeteria, this is a very important piece of information, okay? When you see that cafeteria, you'll see there's a big signpost in the middle of the square. It says, like, Damascus 60 kilometers this way, Iraq is that way, you know, whatever it is, Baghdad. It tells you how far you are from everything. And it's a great, like, picture opportunity if you want. To the left of that is this Kofi Annan. Now, technically speaking, just so you know, most of the food is kosher, but it doesn't have a tuda. It's not a kosher restaurant because it's open on Shabbat. That's why we brought lunch. However, to be fair to them, to walk in a whole group and start eating lunch, so don't obviously start walking in with your sandwiches when you walk in there. They're usually very nice if you come and you buy, and personally, they make unbelievable coffee,
okay.
And that you can definitely get. They have croissants that they order that you can probably eat. I'll check if you want. And they have gifts. And I personally think the Golan has suffered tremendously, tremendously in terms of tourism. And anytime you can come to Israel and buy from Israelis, I personally think it's a mitzvah. Okay? I don't get anything out of this. They don't know my name. You can ask them. But anyway, at 1:40, we're going to meet exactly at that signpost with all the Baghdad Iraq. If you're late, you'll see us a couple minutes later telling the story, walking around. I'll start to the right of that signpost. Then I'm going to go up to the top of the bunker. You'll see us there. But I'm not going to wait because there's other things we want to see. Whoever gets there at 1:40, that's when we start. Okay, now, wait. Whoa! Not done. Two things I want to show you. One, right? Look at this. You are entering a Syrian bunker. This Syrian bunker position, okay, was captured by the Israelis in 67. We lost it in 73 and took it back again. And that is the major part of the story that I'm going to tell you here. Now look how you enter this, okay? The Syrians designed, based on the Russian doctrine, their bunkers, that the entrance to the bunker is a kill zone. This is a kill zone, okay? There's a machine gun up on top. It's facing outward. If it ever gets attacked from here, it just swivels around. You've got 50, 60 yards of open territory. This is a kill zone. This is a very lonely place to come into when you really think about it. You're in a bunker. Okay, it's protected on the one hand. Okay, on the other hand, you understand that this wasn't built as a tourist site. And this is actually an emergency bunker position that in the event gets a bit of war, all the tourists are thrown out and it becomes an active bunker again. There's a terrible battle down here in the Yom Kippur War. Aerial bombardment, artillery. I mean, I'm going to show you the whole story, but the Yom Kippur War was fought and won in the valley below this position. Years after the war, some of the veterans came back. And, you know, they would come back regularly from memorials here and in the valley where the battle was fought. And eventually, one of them got a group together. They hired a sculptor, and they found the remains of a Syrian helicopter. And they took the Syrian helicopter, okay, and they turned it into like a dinosaur, like a child's toy. And when you come here and there's a kids group, they get up here and they play on this, etc. And the image of the Syrian helicopter, the machine of war, becoming sort of the child's playground, is the dream. And the fact that that sits at the entrance of this position is to me mind-boggling. Okay?
What does that say there?
That's just the name of the sculptor. I just wanted to show you this, okay? Here it gets a little narrower, okay? And this is an interesting thing. You're going to see when we walk inside that there's a whole bunker position in there. And yet you see there's a bunker position here. Now why is there a bunker position here if this is supposed to be the entrance to the bunker and the bunker position is all the way over there? So it's very interesting and it's a very sad reason. It's because the Syrians, during the war of attrition between 67 and 73, would regularly shell all the positions in the East Rivim on the Golan. This was a very active border. Okay? The Syrians had not given up on the Golan Heights, and they would constantly shell. Sometimes Israeli positions would come under shell fire for days at a time. And then the Air Force would respond, and the Syrians would respond, and there was always a danger that the war was going to break out here. And eventually it did in 1973. So, the Israelis realized they had a problem in this particular position because that's where the cars would park. That's where buses could come and drop off soldiers after leave. So now you're a soldier, and you're walking up from your bus, right, to get to the bunker. Okay? If the artillery fire starts, and you're here, you're in a lonely place. So you say, well, what's the statistical probability that that would happen? Well, the answer is pretty much every week. Because the Syrians would see these buses come up, they would know that they're dropping off the soldiers, and they would start to bombard them. So what they finally did was they built a bunker here. This bunker, this shelter, is not like the bunker inside. You'll see the difference very obviously. But this is at least a temporary place where you can land and be safe until the artillery ends. Now look at these rocks. This is the hardest rock known to man, okay? These. Okay? This is volcanic rock, basalt rock. Very, very hard rock. It's called bazelet, iron rock in Hebrew. Okay? This breaks the tank treads. And it's one of the symbols of the Golan because Israel overcame it. And it stopped the Syrians, right? And that's why they've taken pieces of these rocks, and that's what they built the shelter out of. But they also took, it's interesting, why don't they just build a wall of rock? Because each rock absorbs more of the shock. Inside there is cement, And by the time the shell actually gets in, it should protect the people inside. The reason that there's wire grating around that is so that when the shell hits, it doesn't send pieces of rock flying everywhere, which could hurt a person still making his way up the path. You know? You want to have an experience. Now we're going to just go and everybody's going to have a chance to lunch. 1:40 at the sign. If you want to see what it must have been like to have to sit here for hours on end and under artillery fire, you can walk in that end and walk out the other end. Look at this sculpture garden. These are all pieces of war machines. Most people don't come here or don't visit or don't know what to do because they think it's so dangerous. Because Israel for them is CNN. All right, if you want to hear the story of this place, okay, so just to reorient you, from up here, you can see very clearly the line of Syrian telling, okay? There are bunker positions on top of those hills. Look how there are just a few hills, and they basically control this whole valley. Right, you're sitting up here with an artillery gun. You can spot, and more importantly, you can see anything that moves. So if you want to retain control of this area, and more importantly, if you want to defend this area, okay, you got to be on top of these telling, okay, on top of these hills. You can see very clearly that on the other side of the mountain there are Syrian positions that are exactly like this position that we're about to see. And basically the fact that there is a static line of defense on both sides of the border is what has pretty much kept the peace. Just a few more details to notice, and then we'll get into the story. Look down there. You see those very square-looking barracks? Okay, that was a Syrian army base. Okay, today it is empty. All right, right in front of you. Okay, that was actually part of the border before after 73. Until 1967, this was basically a valley, and that was a Syrian base. Okay, you can see Har Bental, which is the continuation sort of this ridge over there. And yet a separate hilltop. That's that intelligence base that we won't talk about. You can see Syrian villages, okay, towns really, that grow a little more every time I see them, like Al-Aqsa, which is right over there. Okay, Al-Aqsa, right? Right over there, okay? And most importantly, it's a very hazy day. So, unfortunately, you can't really see, but you know how sometimes in the haze you can see something because you know it's there? So I'll show you where it is, but take a look. Let's see how we do this. All right, you see that village over there, the Arab village?
Yeah.
Okay. In the army we work with finger breaths, okay? Hold your hand out, okay? On the edge of that village, all right, five fingers, and on your left of your hand you'll see a like a white strip of like path.
Yeah.
Okay, that's called the booster. I'm going to talk about that in a little while. That's called the booster, okay? Now hold your thumb. If you look above that path, there's like a little, kind of looks like a little white hill.
Yeah.
See that?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if you look a little further away, you see what looks like a quarry, another like a white cliff or hill. You see that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And to the right, two fingers to the right of that white cliff, you can just barely make out buildings. Yeah. That's Damascus.
Oh, my God.
That is Damascus, okay? On a clear day, you can see it very clearly. In 1973, Yanush brought his brigade up here, and they basically took this whole line. Okay? We are now in the northern end of the Golan, alright? Basically, this way is north, that is east. In fact, you look just up beyond the fence on the ridge, you can see a very sharp hill. See that? Mountain? See that? All the way over there. It's like, after that, you can't see anything else. See that?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, that is Mount Hermon. That is the tallest spot, the highest spot in Israel. It's called in Hebrew, Enei HaMdina, the eyes of the country. Because from the listening devices and the special imagery that's located up there, you can see deep into Syria. And most importantly, that's the advanced warning station that allows Israel to know that something's coming her way. One of the first things that happened in 1973 was that Syrian commandos, two full helicopters of Syrian commandos. And by the way, maybe I just need to explain to you what a Syrian commando is. You have to be over 6 foot. You sign on to the Syrian army for 5 years. You start your training, your entry, your acceptance to the Syrian commando by being given a chicken. You have to rip the chicken's head off, reach inside the chicken's body, pull out a heart, and eat it. This is true. This is not something out of the movies. This is what they're trying to breed. These men are the elite of the Syrian army. They're trained in all sorts of different types of warfare. We fought Syrian commandos in Lebanon, in the areas of Ain Sakhalta and in the Bekaa Valley. Frightening, frightening guys. And in fact, one of my battalion commanders had a Syrian commando climbing up on his tank. And in the middle of the night on guard duty, because officers do guard duty also in the field, he's just kind of like standing there trying to keep awake, and all of a sudden sees a guy this distance from him with a knife in his teeth, like something out of the movies, climbing up his tank. And he was so close, he didn't have the chance to take out his gun and pull it, and you know, it was too close. Right? It's like next to him, just to fight him hand to hand. And on the one hand, he had the advantage because he was higher. On the other hand, he was at a disadvantage because he was in a turret. So he couldn't like get out, and he was told... Anyway, now we got into Syrian commandos. Well, he lived to tell the tale. It's a whole story. If you remind me on the bus, I'll tell you the story. But two helicopter loads of Syrian commandos landed on top of the Hermon, surrounded the company of men. So you're talking about 300, a battalion, but 500, probably a little less, Syrian commandos land on the Hermon on Yom Kippur afternoon in 1973, completely surround their position, okay, and basically take over the Hermon. They butchered the entire company. Most of them were killed, not all of them. It took Israel 3 days of fighting and warfare to finally have the kochot, the strength, to be able to send men back up, land helicopters down there, fight a pitched battle, and retake the Hermon. The things that they found, what they had done, different body parts that had been stuffed with different body parts, are just beyond description. And today, without going into details, the system up in the Hermon is a totally different system. There are a lot more men up there. I once served up there in the winter, and it's very cold up there, but it's great tonight. It's like the dream miluim, because you go up there, they give you these intense kanadiot, these like thermal-like suits, and most of the time you're sitting indoors, and everyone's like in the morning and the afternoon you have to do a patrol, and you know, very easy to spot footprints in the snow, and you know, TV, movies, everything you need, you know, a couple of weeks hanging out, R&R, unbelievable davening up there in the Hermon, and but I wouldn't have wanted to have been there in 1973. In any event, you can see, you know, you can read about this, but you don't get it till you're here. Because you look at that Hermon. Now, by the way, Syria demands that we give back or give away, depending on your perspective, the Hermon mountain range. If you come up here, I can tell you, you see where the Hermon is? To the right of the Hermon, where the snow actually is, that's already Syria. Okay, we control only 3% of the Hermon mountain range. Only 3%. Now, by the way, the other side of the Hermon, heading northwards, right, is Lebanon. Okay? So Lebanon is also very, very close to where we are right now. Alright? We're about, I would say, a half an hour drive from Lebanon and a 3 minute drive from Syria. Pleasant place to be. Anyway, 1973. The 188th Brigade is arrayed further in the southern part, and the 7th, especially the 77th, which is a battalion of the 7th, is in this area. And these are their bases. Okay? This unit, this battalion, is one of the most famous battalions now in Israel because of the story I'm about to tell you. It's called Oz Shivim V'Sheva, the strength of 77. And it was the 77th battalion. It was commanded by a fellow who later became a famous politician called Avigdor Kaalani. And he was the battalion commander of this unit.
At that time, this was
We're talking about 1973. In 1973, 6 years after the Six-Day War, we had taken this area. The artillery bombardment of Yishuvim and Kibbutzim below us had stopped. There were a dozen different town settlements that had already been built in the last 6 years. Okay? Half of Efrat didn't exist 6 years ago, so that just gives you an idea. Did we take more of the Golan?
We took it in 67. Like, did we take more of it back in 73?
We actually ended up giving more than what was. We controlled, for example, Kunetra between 67 and 73, and we gave it back to them as a result of the 73 ceasefire.
We gave them.
Yeah, but let's first talk the story, and then we'll... Okay. So, 1973. Early in the morning, the Syrians begin an intense bombardment. Now, by the way, how many miles would you say it is from here to those telling? From here to those hills. The Syrian hills. Yeah. Okay, it's about 8 miles, so you're close. 8 miles. Which means, obviously, that this is all artillery range. Okay?
As far as artillery range.
Right. 25 miles. Back then, it was actually closer to about 18. Okay? Because we have better guns now. They actually now have developed a gun, which isn't in service yet, and the British, I think the British developed it, I might be wrong, but they want to bring it to Iraq, which has a 50-mile range.
Wow.
50-mile accurate range, which is unbelievable. An artillery gun.
It's not a missile.
Yeah, 185 millimeters. What?
It's like a missile.
Yeah, well, basically. Anyway, let's not get off track. So, they begin an unrelenting bombardment, artillery bombardment, of all the Israeli positions along the line. Now, because they were softening them up. Now, that does two things. First of all, when you're under artillery fire, you have to get indoors. So everybody slides into the bunkers. And what's happening when you're in the bunkers? You can't see what's going on. So the Syrians can move their troops out, and you're not ready. Okay? This goes on hour after hour after hour. Now realize that this was not a new phenomenon. The Syrians were clever, and so were the Egyptians, by the way. They basically bombarded here every third day. And they did just enough without starting a war. Because they didn't want the Israelis to call up troops, but they wanted them to get used to the bombardment. So this one was a little more severe. Janosch, who's the only madman who sees what's coming, says, you know what? This is not good. There are too many troops out there. This bombardment is lasting too long. There's going to be a war, and it's going to start this afternoon. So he calls in his battalion commanders, and he tells them, listen, I want you to get your tanks out from under the camouflage, and I want you to move them down to the front positions. Okay? Now, battle is controlled from what's called rampot, the ramps. Okay? These are natural low hills. Right? Think about that green area over there fighting in a battle. You're opposite a tank. He sees you, you see him. And think about that as compared to being behind one of those low hills over there, the busto, right? If you're behind that ridge and you're firing down, the only thing he can see is your gun and turret. You're a much smaller target. So you can stay longer in your firing range. So they have to get these positions. So there are three battalion commanders. Two of them are still getting their tanks online. Remember, they only moved up to the Golan a couple of days ago. You don't transport tanks with all of their shells and everything else. The gear, the things that you need to fix them. It's a lot of work to load up a tank. It takes 6 to 8 hours just to get it out of the whatever. So the only one who's really ready is Avigdor Kalani. So Kalani takes his battalion. Okay, a battalion is three companies. You're talking about, it should be 33 tanks, 35 tanks. It really is about 25 tanks because they don't have enough. And he spreads his tanks out across that valley. Okay? He still does not know what's coming. But they're ready to roll. And they take cover positions. And because the Syrians are doing the bombardment, they don't really land on the tanks. And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Avigdor Kalani, and you can read this in his book, looks across. And he sees basically, and I've met people who fought in this battle, look at that valley there. That entire valley is full of Syrian armor. Now, do you remember there was one point we were riding and we saw like a jeep or a tank and it was like sending up smoke? Mm-hmm. Remember that? And I wasn't sure if it was a fire or smoke. That's what one jeep or one tank looked like. Imagine, okay, 650 tanks. 650 tanks. Okay? 650 tanks are pouring through this valley. Now, I have to explain to you why that is. Okay? And you'll need to look at the map if you want to understand this. Okay? Okay, so, think about this, okay? You won't see this unless you're on the bottom. This is Syria, okay? Jordan. Now, we know that the Jordan River, I told you, is Ma'barot. It's not passable to tanks. This is the Kinneret, right? Not passable to tanks. For Syrian armor, where do the Syrians want to get to? They want to get here. This is the belly of Israel. This is where the ports are. Syria does not have a port. They want this port. That's why they control Lebanon, because they want that port. They want this. They want Haifa, Tel Aviv, Herzliya, Ranana, Kfar Saba, Ashkelon, Ashdod. This is what they want. And this is what they've always wanted. Every nation, every empire that has ever wanted to take control of this country has wanted this, this strip of land. Okay? The Arameans, Aram, the Assyrians, Ashur, the Babylonians, the Persians, all the way through to the Romans, the Byzantines, everybody. That's why the Romans built cities here like Caesarea, Caesar. Okay? So, there are only a few natural places. You can see it on today's roads. See this road? Okay? This is part of the Beirut-Damascus Highway. Okay? It's a natural road that connects. Because back in the times of the British, the Turks, and before them, the Mamluks, the Ottomans, the Byzantines, etc., etc., etc. Right? All the way back, so the Romans and the Persians and the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Arameans, etc. Same trade route. This is a natural rift through the mountains. The Golan Heights mountains here and here prevent it. And there's one here, and there's one here. Now this one, if you can see over here, okay, this doesn't go anywhere. This goes to the Kinneret. Then you have to go around to the Kinneret, and there are other reasons not to go here. This is good if you're going up. If you're going up into the Golan Heights, then this is the way you go. Okay? Because the grade is less steep, and you're already here. But if you want to get to the coastal region, this is the natural road. Just so you know, okay? Has anybody ever heard of Megiddo?
Yeah.
Okay, Megiddo. Megiddo is a place, okay, not to be confused with Armageddon, that's another thing, but some say it's the same place. But Megiddo is an amazing historical site, where you can find layer upon layer upon layer upon layer, all the way back for 3,000, really 5,000 years. Back to the time of the Canaanites and Abraham. Why is Megiddo such an important place? Why did every civilization build a fortress place? Because Megiddo sits right here at the crossroads. Okay? This natural bridge to get to the coastal region, the crossroads here, a very strategic place. To this day, there's a very important military base that sits here that controls the crossroads. Egypt's going to come up here. Syria's going to come down here. That's their plan. So we have to stop them here. Understand? There are only two ways they can connect to that road from the Golan Heights, and this is one of them. This is a natural valley that comes all the way from Damascus and heads all the way down behind this ridge straight to the coastal region, nothing to stop it. Around the northern tip of the Kinneret, Gamarna. So of the 2,000 tanks that come through here, 650 of them come through that valley. Now think about this. You're 25 tanks. You're facing 650 tanks. This is crazy. Crazy. But they have no choice. There's so many tanks on the front line here. Tanks are pouring across these valleys that there's an Israeli military radio vehicle that's trying to get up to the front line so it can report on the news. You know, they can't find the front lines. They keep running into Syrian tanks because there are no front lines. There's no one else up here. Half the standing army is on leave for Yom Kippur. The reserves have not been called up yet. There's no one here. Balagan. Huge disarray. Avigdor Kalani calls his men together. They have no choice. And the battle begins in earnest, okay, late in the afternoon of Yom Kippur. Now, to understand this a little more, we have to walk up to the top of the hill and see the rest of this bunker position. Come follow me.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.